Okay, I'm going to get started. I'm Kate Carmody. I am the curatorial assistant who worked with the senior curator for architecture and design here at MoMA, Paolo Antonelli, on Talk to Me. And I know there was a little mix-up in the schedule. I think it was printed that it was Lawi Fuller today, but it's actually Talk to Me, and that was last week. Mm-hmm. So just so you know, you're here for the Talk to Me lecture. And Talk to Me is on view right now in the special exhibition galleries on the third floor. So if you have time after the lecture, I really encourage you to go up and check the show out. And I'm going to talk today a little bit about how we conceived of the exhibition, how we went about our research, and how we put the exhibition together, as well as what is actually in the exhibition. I will get started. So Talk to Me was conceived of in before I started working here at MoMA. Paolo did a show in 2008 called Design in the Elastic Mind, and there was a category in that show called People and Objects, and Design in the Elastic Mind was really about science and design, and also contemporary design at the time, so a design that covered anything from the year 2000 to about 2008. And this topic kind of grew out of that show, and Paolo had proposed it and gotten it approved by the exhibitions committee, because that's how things work here at MoMA, and it was already on the schedule by the time I started working here in 2009. We started researching in earnest for the show in about February of 2010, and in order to do that, we set up a blog, which we call the Journal, and we wanted to have the central thesis of the show, which is about the communication between people and objects, and the kind of open communication between the digital world and the physical world, part of our research process, as well as the thesis for the show. So we decided to set up this blog. We didn't publicize it greatly. We didn't put it onto the main MoMA webpage or Facebook or anything like that. We wanted it to really be a tool for us in our research, and secondary, be a way for people in the design community who are working in this type of design to contact us and submit things to us. So on the site, it was a really simple WordPress site. I had to learn WordPress. And we set up all these different tabs. And so what we did was anything we found looking at blogs, something that someone had told us about, something that we saw when we visited a gallery or a show. Another huge part of doing research for an upcoming show is travel. Paolo traveled to several places. She went to Japan, and she went to England, and I went to Texas. And anything we saw, we would kind of mark and bookmark and in this Q category. So in the Q category, we put anything and everything that we thought might possibly fit into the show. And then once a week, Paolo and I would sit down and go through it, usually with one of our interns, and discuss if those pieces really were Talk to Me and if they really were something that we wanted to pursue for the show. If the project was something we wanted to pursue, we would put it in this checked category. And under checked, we kind of organize things in this very straightforward taxonomy. So we organize them by interfaces or interactions or communication. We had a couple interesting categories we called pets and fairy tales, because a lot of these devices ended up having these kind of characters about them, and we thought they were a lot like little pets. There was another category called liminal spaces, which is what we've been calling this this category of projects, like I said, that bridges the divide between the physical and the digital. So we did this first pass and organized things into these different categories. And it was really helpful for our research. And then we also would put any readings we found, our bibliography, links to different articles. And then under links, there's actually, if you go check out this blog, it's still up, which is great, because that means it's going to kind of remain a resource for design, in this type of design, interactive design, from this time period. And under links, there's a category called Tasty Morsels, which is where we put things that we couldn't categorize. And it's got a lot of fun things on there. So when we had to start working on the catalog, which is the first thing that you work on when you're working on an exhibition, because of the lead time of a book it takes to make a book versus the lead time of what it takes to make an exhibition, we had to really edit ourselves once more. And Paolo's shows, like every show at MoMA, have three components. They have the gallery exhibition itself, the catalog, and the website. So every show ends up having a website. And the blog for our show grew into having this professionally designed website by Stamen Design, who are also featured in the show. And what we really wanted to capture with the catalog and with the website and with the galleries was this liminal space. And so if you go into the galleries, when you go up there today, here's the catalog. And when you go into the galleries, I just wanted to point out, on every label, there is this little pixelated thing called a QR code. And when you scan that with an application on a smartphone, it'll take you back to our website and the page for that piece on our website. And in many cases, there's additional content. There's more videos, there's more photos, there's more text, because we were very limited by the space we had in the galleries. So in that way, we were able to add this fourth dimension of connecting the book, the catalog, and the gallery space via this QR code. In the book, we also have them. And so when you're sitting down and reading about this film or this trailer, this piece, you can scan it and automatically a video will pop up and show you the piece in action. We wanted to offer up this show as kind of a guinea pig for the experimental use of QR codes in museums. This is the first show that has used QR codes here at MoMA, and I think it's one of the first shows in the U.S. that's used QR codes. I know there was a couple of museums in Germany using them last year, and I know the Whitney has begun to use them. But we really wanted to experiment, and our digital media department was really enthusiastic and really eager to see what we could do with them. But one of the main concerns that we had was that we didn't want people who don't have access to smartphones, and who don't know how to use smartphones, or who don't want to use smartphones, have a lesser experience when they came through the galleries. So you can still get all of the information, all of the images, and all of the video content in the galleries, but we wanted it to be kind of this fun, enhanced experience if you so desired it. And with design exhibitions in particular, I feel that there's definitely two audiences that we cater to. There's the general public that come through maybe on their way to see de Kooning, or maybe on their way to see Magritte or Van Gogh, and they end up in a design exhibition. And then they have to kind of navigate and see what's different about the art and recontextualize design. And then there's the design expert audience. And so the QR codes were more of a thing to put out there for the people working in this field, because the QR codes end up being one of the main tools used in a lot of these projects for communication. And you know, they bring up another issue that maybe in a month or two they could be completely obsolete, and that's one thing that we considered when we were putting together the show. But because we're working on a contemporary design exhibition, we had to kind of go with what was happening right now, and this ends up being a snapshot of what design is and communication design is from about really 2005 to now. There's one piece that's a little bit older in the show from 1999, but that's the oldest piece in the show. So it's really, really contemporary. And when we're working on these three different things simultaneously, the website, the gallery, and the catalog, we find things that we want to add after we've kind of completed one. So for example, in the catalog, there's about 160 projects. In the galleries, there are about 180 projects. And then on the website, there's almost 200 projects. So that happens with Paula's shows in particular, because it's such a contemporary show. Usually if you have a website and a catalog and a gallery for de Kooning, for example, everything will be in the catalog, everything will be on the site, and everything will be in the galleries. But here we were able to kind of add as we went along. So part of the experience of the galleries is definitely this QR code thing and how digital media can enhance your experience of the exhibition. And this guy, Talking Carl, you'll see him when you go up there, was an app designed for the iPhone and then repurposed for the iPad. And it's a little character who giggles and can be tickled and talks back to you. And this brings up a really interesting idea that we had to confront when doing research for the show. So if we started researching the show in like February 2010, spring 2010, the iPad came out, and it kind of revolutionized the way people were communicating with screens. And when that happens, we had to really sit down and consider, are we going to release an app that goes along with this show? Is the iPad something that's really new and exciting, but, you know, maybe it shouldn't be in the show? It's not good communication design. Do we want the whole show to be iPads? Do we want it to look like an Apple showroom? You know, all of these ideas we have to go through and consider. And iPads are particular. Everyone was really excited about the idea of having an iPad in the gallery because of the interactive possibilities, but there's a lot of things that have to happen to the iPad itself, so people cannot hack through it. And there's lots of people who like to do that. So in this case, we built this little case around it, so no buttons can be accessed, and the app stays playing. And there's some other iPads in the show that are also boxed off, so people can't turn them off and put different apps on them, because we did experiment with an iPad. Or iPhones in another exhibition, and for some reason everyone just loves to come to MoMA and play digital poker. They keep going out of the application we wanted them to use, and they really like playing that poker. So when we were designing the exhibition, we really and all the exhibition design here at MoMA is done in-house. So we have an in-house exhibitions architecture team, and Betty Fisher was the architect on this show, who was great. And they really get involved with the concept of the show and the idea of the show, as well as just designing cases and laying out the galleries. So a lot of different considerations had to be taken into account when looking at the pieces that we had in this show. So for example, we have over 80 monitors, and many, many, many of the pieces required Wi-Fi and direct Wi-Fi or direct hookup to the internet, as well as electricity. So if 80% of the show needed these considerations, Betty really had to take into account how much power we needed in the gallery. So we actually ended up having to pull an additional 44 circuits to this space, which was a huge job, and so we wouldn't blow any fuses. And then we also had to up the Wi-Fi coverage in the area 300%, because we wanted the QR things to work, but we also wanted the objects themselves to be able to work. And Betty and Paula and I worked on designing the cases. Paula was very enamored with Carl, as you can tell. He inspired the entire casework. So everything has rounded edges and is very orange and squarish, just like Carl. And then Betty was able to work with our amazing AV team and IT team to hide all of the wiring and all of the Cat5 for the internet and all of the electricity for the pieces within the casework. And if when you go up to the show, you can look at the very top here. These things don't come exactly to the ceiling. All of the power is pulled down into the units themselves. And we even were able to inlay monitors into the cases, because one of the other major things when you're doing a show on design, and especially a show on interaction design, is you're taking the design out of context. As soon as we take a chair and we put it on a pedestal, it's no longer a chair. Nobody's allowed to sit on it. And that's true for most design, which is not true for art. And I think that's one of the major differences. Everyone's always asking about the difference between design and art. And I don't really have an answer. I don't know that much about art, but I know about design. And for me, it's the fact that design is always designed with someone else in mind. It's always designed with kind of a context in mind. And when we exhibit it, we automatically take it out of that context. And for an interaction design show, a lot of these pieces could be interactive. So if we were showing a website, or if we were showing some sort of iPhone application or a device, we could show that working and we could invite the public to work with it. But a lot of these pieces were designed by student designers. They were one-offs. They were created and are not going to be intended for manufacturing. So they're prototypes, and those things are not robust enough to be interacted with by 30,000 people on a daily basis. And so the way we had to go about showing how these pieces actually interact was, in a lot of cases, we had to show videos, hence the 80 monitors. We had to show demos sometimes. So even if it was a video project, like a video game where you build your own level, there's a lot of these kind of really involved video games in the show. And so for some of them, we can have people play. But for other ones, we you know, you can't have someone playing an online game that takes years and years to build a world in the galleries, because that's no fun and people don't understand why it's in the galleries. So some cases we have photographs or wallpapers or pictures, and we really, really had to think about how to get across the fact that all of these pieces are interactive. So the videos, the demos are one way, and then there is a lot of text, and that's part of the reason why we wanted to also incorporate the QR tags, because when you're going through a show, I totally understand you don't want to stand there and read every single label, but if sometimes you wanted to scan and bookmark the label or the piece, you could do that. So one of the pieces that we did have interactive, that was a huge effort because we were working with the MTA, is the oldest piece in the show from 1999, designed by Antenna and the MTA, the MTA MetroCard machine. And we were able to work with them to get special Talk to Me cards. So if you go up there, you can actually purchase a MetroCard. It's working, and a special Talk to Me card will come out. And like I said, all of these videos are embedded in the cases, demonstrate how these pieces work. All these pieces are kind of build your own, do it yourself hardware, and we really wanted to get across their possibilities and the great design, and not have them just stagnant in a case. And then we have the QR codes. And so now I'm going to go into a little bit about the organization of the show. And as I explained back when I was talking about how we first organized things on the blog under the Q tab and the check tab into these very kind of general interfaces, interactions, communications, categories. As we started working on the catalog, we realized that those weren't really working, and we had to organize the objects and the projects in the show based on this other, another taxonomy. And what we decided on was organizing the projects based on scale. So organizing the projects based on what is actually talking in the project, or what is actually talking to you from this project. This first category we came up with was objects. So objects that interact with people, so from devices to interfaces to characters, a lot of the pets fall into this category, they're objects. We organized it based on that. The Tweenbot has become one of the unofficial mascots of the exhibition, and represents another way that we were able to bring the interactivity into the galleries from the original context. The designer, Casey Kinzer, was a student at ITP at NYU, and what she did was create this very simple cardboard robot with no directional sense whatsoever. He just goes forward, and he's just a motor covered in a cardboard sheath and a smile, and he's got a flag that says, "Please help me get to the southeast corner of Washington Square." And so she just released him, and to her amazement, she was able to, everybody helped him, and he always got to his destination. He was never kicked, he was never run over, he was never trashed. And everyone was willing to help him just based on his cute face, right? So one of the things we were able to do was work with Casey, and she made us four additional Tweenbots, and we have one in the galleries here. This one is named Sam, I think. And then we have three others that travel from the lobby to the galleries on a weekly basis. It's actually happening right now. And I was saying to Janelle, it's lucky she's an intern in my department, because the duty of my intern is Tweenbot babysitting. So this was last week, and it is really engaging, and we have kids definitely really engaging with the Tweenbot. So we move into this category of objects, right? So some of the other objects that we featured in the show are these pieces, some of my favorites, by James Chambers. And what James Chambers did, he imagined a fictional design group called the Attenborough Design Group, named for Sir David Attenborough, that imbues products with animal qualities in order to keep them going longer. So it's a way of putting natural selection into product design. And what he's made are this radio that's called the Gesundheit Radio, which sneezes to dust itself, and the Floppy Lights hard drive, which stands up if it's under threat of being ruined. And I can show you a little video so you understand how it works. Here we go. Oh, I have a Tweenbot video as well. So Casey, I'll show you a brief glimpse of this. Casey put a hidden camera in her purse, and was able to tape people interacting with the Tweedbots in Washington Square. And it's great because it shows this kind of central thesis of our show, which is that designers are no longer putting objects out there to be accepted by the public or to be just used by the public. Designers are putting out experiences, putting out objects that that require a dialogue with the user, with the consumer. And the Tweenbot is a really great example of this, is that she's creating an interaction by putting this into people's everyday space. So he goes pretty slow, but he's helped by, so she was filming this out of her purse, trying not to be obvious. And, you know, in some cases, his wheels will fall off and people stop and fix it, or people will start talking to one another, even though they're strangers, to kind of help him along. So, yeah, he gets stuck in potholes a lot. Here at MoMA, he gets stuck on the escalator. That's been a problem. So you can see this whole video upstairs, but I just wanted to show you a little bit of it. And then the design interactions of the floppy legs hard drive. So you can see exactly what these objects do. And these are an example of these objects that are one of a kind. That we couldn't have running, and you'll see for different reasons in the gallery. We didn't want people to be pushing and making him sneeze. He does sneeze on his own. He's programmed to sneeze every 6 months to dust himself. And then with the floppy legs hard drive, he is able to sense if there's liquid on the desk and will stand up so he doesn't get ruined by spilled coffee. And we couldn't have liquid in the gallery or have people pouring liquid on objects. So definitely we had to have a video in this case. So, very cute, he's my favorite. So, and then he lays back down, he's able to lay back down. So the idea of this object is, they're pretty whimsical, but it's also this idea of these older, the anti-touch lamp was one we didn't end up having in the show. It's a halogen bulb that kind of sways away if people try to touch it. It's very shy to avoid the bulb getting ruined. But what I was going to say is that these pieces themselves, bring about another major theme that we have been seeing in the show. Kind of older forms, radios or hard drives that look older, being imbued with newer technologies. So, for example, in the gallery we have iPhones that are fitting into books. So, or a Wi-Fi dousing rod, for example. So, all of these things, these ancient forms and the new technologies being combined. Another major theme that runs through the show is this emotional contact that we have, or emotional communication that we have with objects. And this is a piece that was done by Jeffrey Mann, and he took the dialogue from a film in which a heated argument happens and created a table space that absorbed the emotion and the sound and passes it back and forth across the table. It's one of the first pieces you see when you walk into the galleries, and it really embodied what we wanted to get across with the show, this emotional aspect that we have with objects. And then moving from these objects that engage with us on a certain level, we move up the scale into objects that allow us to engage with our own bodies. And one of the definitions we've been using of interfaces is something that gives us access to a complex network and system. And one of the most complex networks and systems is the human body. And this is a little thing that is an actual prototype. It's going to be released on the market probably really soon, designed by some researchers at the University of Florida. And it's a pill that has an antenna and a microchip. And when you swallow it, it signals to your doctor or caregiver that you've actually taken your medicine. Realizing that medication compliance is a huge part of treating a disease, they were able to make an antenna that will dissolve with your stomach acid, and then the rest of the chip will just pass out your digestive system. So it's not harmful, and it will alert your doctor or caregiver that you've actually taken your medicine. Another project that has gotten a lot of attention is the iWriter project, and it was designed by a group of graffiti artists for their friend who had been stricken with ALS, Lou Gehrig syndrome, and he cannot move in his hospital bed except for his eyes. And he used to be a graffiti artist, or he still is a graffiti artist, but he used to tag buildings in downtown Los Angeles with his name. His name is Tempt One. And they were able to create using a pair of really inexpensive eyeglasses, a camera from a video game console, and open source software, a set of glasses that trace his eye movements, and he's able to draw with his eyes, color with his eyes, send the drawing that he's done to a laptop that's projected onto a building in downtown LA, so he's able to still be outside and doing his artwork that way. And this represents another major theme of things in our show, this open source collaborative design. So the design itself is this communication between all of these people working on the software, and then they release it. It's for free. They release the software and tell you how to make this yourself for free. And that's a big part of this, and it's very anti-museum. I can't tell you, you know, when you're working with artists who have their estates and to use an image, it costs money and there's photo rights and all of these things. Working with these designers was a dream because they would just send me things and I wouldn't have to get permission and they were okay with me using everything. So it's a very different mentality that's grown with the internet because everybody's knowledge is accessible in that way. Moving out of the body, communicating with your body, we were moving up the scale into communicating with your life. So communicating with your lifestyle or communicating with your ancestors, it's really, you know, social networks, or even communicating with your religion or anything like that. And one of my favorite projects is this project done by a Brooklyn designer, Nicholas Felton. And every year for the last 5 years, he's collected data on himself. Where he ate, where he drank, who he met, who he talked to, where he lived, and how much, where he spent time. And then every year, at the end of the year, he produces a annual report on himself. So it's this way of really storytelling through this visualization design. And he calls it a dehydrated story. So you can look and see the story of his life over the last year in a very scientific way. And visualizations were originally developed to render scientific data or information more understandable, and they become this language of visual communication and design that we can hardly escape. The New York Times uses them all the time, and he's taken this language and applied it to his own life. As I was saying, there's some video games in the show, and this is one that's been really popular, and this is one you can actually play up in the show, because it takes everybody who plays it 5 minutes to play. It's called Passage. It was designed by an independent game designer named Jason Rohr. And what it is a game that kind of, it's like a memento mori in the form of a video game. So you begin as a young man, and as you start out, you can choose to fall in love. If you choose to take a partner, it becomes a little harder. But it's more rewarding, you get more points. If you decide to go it alone, you move faster, but you die quicker. And everybody dies at the end, no matter what. It's this language of video games where you get extra lives and you get to keep going and always keep playing and keep playing. This one, you only get one life and you die at the end. And if your partner dies, you're significantly slowed down by grief. Here he is sitting at his wife's grave, it's really sad. And then at the end, you know, you have points, and then your tombstone pops up, and Jason says, like, it ends up showing that life is pretty meaningless when you have the little points hovering above your tombstone. So I have a little demo I can play of Passage, but you can play it up in the galleries if you want. So it's this very kind of meditative music. This is the demo of someone playing it and explaining what's happening. So you can go through life opening these treasure chests, and sometimes there's rewards, sometimes there's nothing. You know, it's very zen, I guess. So you have to go through the obstacles, and it's harder when you're a pair. And it was done in 2008, which also brings up an interesting, on Monday when I did this lecture on Tuesday, someone asked, when was this made? And I said 2008, because it's this very retro look, and that's what a lot of the stuff, it's almost like we have this language has been around since the early 80s for the last 30 years of pixels and video games and digital communication, more than 30 years, but it's been mainstream for about 30 years. And it's almost like fashion or anything else. The older video games are inspiring the newer styles of designers now. This is another piece that's in the life section that has to do with, it's a book that was designed by a Dutch designer, and what she did is she took a random pig from a commercial farm in the Netherlands, and she traced every single product that was made from that pig, and she took a picture, she tracked it down and took a picture of it and documented it in this book. And the book is about this thick. You can see it's categorized from enamel that was used in porcelain sculptures to dog food, to hemoglobin used in cigarettes, to marshmallows, all the foodstuffs, but things you would never think animal products went into, film for cameras. She even used glue made from the pig's bones to bind the book. And so this is a visualization of the life of one animal, but it also brings to light our global food economy and how animal products are a huge part of that. And then Still in Life is this project, which I really like. There's a few things in the exhibition that are like real prototypes, like I showed you of the swallow signaling pill. And then there's more critical design or design for debate, which comes out of, oftentimes it comes out of this design interactions program at the Royal College of Art. And this is a piece that has been designed to take advantage of an existing technology that takes a thermal image of your face, and then it guesses at your emotional state. So this camera and this technology is actually being used at some border crossings to kind of gauge maybe malicious intent or gauge if somebody is going to commit a crime. It's a very dangerous technology. And these designers worked with the scientists who are developing it to create a piece called Happy Life, and they envisioned that you would have this camera at your door, and every time you left and every time you came home, it would take a picture of you and your family members, and this data would then be collected over time, and these dials, these kind of emotional barometers installed in your house would soon learn how to dictate how you are going to feel before you feel it. So you could come home and see your wife's dial completely off, and then you would be totally mystified as to what happened. And they created all of these scenarios. This one, the caption for this one was that the barometer, the device, was able to predict their coming sadness because the anniversary of a loved one's death was coming up, and so the barometer indicated that they should be feeling sad this time of year. So this is definitely based on existing technology, and they really do want to install it in a home and see how families live with it. But it's one of these very critical pieces, talking about different themes and things that are happening in our society through design. And moving from the scale of your family and your social network, you move into the larger scale of the city and being an inhabitant of the city. And this is a piece called Baker Tweet. And it's this device that is very robust. It's designed to be put into a kitchen. These guys in London at Polk had a really great bakery across the street from their office, and they wanted to go over there when things were fresh. And so they developed this device for the baker that he can scroll through and say what just came out of the oven. So here, pain au chocolat or croissants or bread. And then he, you know, dials through and pushes the button, and it automatically tweets to the followers what has just come out of the oven, so they could run back across and get it. So it's this idea of this communication in the city, word of mouth, or maybe smelling fresh bread or something like that, but in the digital realm. And again, in order to get this to be kind of an obvious translation into the gallery space, we installed it in Cafe 2 upstairs. So if you follow the tweets, I think it's at MoMA Baker Tweet, you'll learn about specials from Cafe 2 or what cookies just came out of the oven or cocktails or things like that. And if you go have lunch, you can see them using it. And then in the city, there's also these very obvious ways that people are using digital communications. This is a QR code that is installed on the facade of an entire building in Tokyo. And in Tokyo, they've been using these QR codes for years, for 10 years or more. And when you scan it with your phone, you can see who's inside and what they're tweeting, what sales are happening, what's going on inside the building, and then they can also install a digital decoration. So Christmas time, there's a giant tree on the top, things like that. And then part of the city is this mapping. So a lot of these are really straightforward maps navigating your city, but a lot of these are also this visualization of data that's being put out into the world by users, and then designers are just harnessing this free data. So for example, these are a series of maps. I think there's over 170 in total of different cities that pull data from Flickr, the online photo uploading site. And he coded a program that would separate people's account zip codes and their photos, which are tagged with GPS information. And he was able to determine the photos taken by tourists are red, and the photos taken by locals are blue, and the photos taken by the yellows are unknown. So this is London and New York, and you can see tourists tend to be right around here, all in Central Park, MoMA, right, and Ground Zero. And then the locals are much further out. And then also in London, the center city of London, all the historic parts tend to be much more tourist heavy. So it's interesting in that he didn't have to ask for any of this data. It's just readily available, and he was able to write software to render these maps. And then moving up from the city, there's pieces in the show that fall into the category of worlds. And the worlds category is really, you know, threefold. It is about communicating with the natural world. It's about communicating with the global news media and how communication is really designed when it's released out into the world. And it's also about communicating with this liminal space, this virtual world that I keep mentioning. So this project is about communicating with the natural world for children. It's an ant helmet and these paws, and you can see the ant's eye view through the paws. So it magnifies everything you touch about 10,000%, and you can see what an ant would be seeing if you touch anything with the paws. And this is a giraffe converter. So it makes you taller and lowers your voice. So it's meant to be a giraffe, but it really is a child to adult converter. So you can see from the perspective of an adult. And then we were able to sometimes have demos in the galleries and stuff. The designer here is showing off how the ant helmet works. And this is a piece, when I was talking about the communicating with the global news media, done by Berg in London. And it's a website that you can go to and type in your zip code, and then choose from any kind of global event that's happened and apply it to your own zip code. Apply that space to your own zip code. So, for example, here is the Apollo 11 space flight walk on a neighborhood in London. So you can see it was about three blocks they walked on the moon. And then here you can see the oil spill, if it had happened over the city of London. I went and put the Pakistani floods that had happened over my Brooklyn zip code, and it covers the whole East Coast. So it's a way of really bringing home the scale of these events to your actual, to terms that you actually understand. This is another piece, one of the older pieces in the show. This is from 2004, a website designed by Josh Ahn. And it shows the networks of corporations and who's on the boards of these corporations and what boards those board members are on and what boards those members are on and what parts of government those people are on. And it exposes these almost collusions between government and corporate America. And it's a way of seeing these connections that are never exposed. So it's this visualization, but also exposure of information. And then in the virtual world, We have a lot of projects, and this is one of my favorites. It's called the Avatar Machine, and it's a suit that one wears out in the real world to feel as if you're working in a video game. So this part behind you right here is this camera, or you can see it up here, kind of films you from behind. So if you have ever played a first-person kind of shooter video game, you always see that kind of back of the character's head, or you see the point of view with the gun out in front of you, and that's what this does. It projects what's behind you into your visor here, so you see yourself in as you would in a regular environment, but in the real environment. Also in the virtual world, we have a lot of these projects, like I said, that use these codes. This is a project done in England called Hungry Hungry Eat Head, where people would engage with this giant screen by holding the codes up, and then their heads would change into these monsters. And just by kind of changing that stuff around, it's communicating, but it's also this kind of fun, whimsical idea. And here we have an earlier project. This is a SEMA code. It's not quite the same as a QR code. It's an earlier barcode that this designer mowed into a field in Germany. And he was hoping that when the cameras flew over to photograph every part of the world for Google Earth, that this would be captured in Google Earth. And when you scan it, it says, "Hello, world." And that is a traditional phrase that programmers, people working in computers, the first thing that they will program in a new language. So it's this kind of tenfold description or tenfold explanation for why it says that. And then there's all sorts of projects that deal with augmented reality. This is a piece that a designer did that has a hidden camera in the lamp, and as you flip through this book, the drawings come to life. And this is kind of the next step out of the QR codes, not having to have any codes at all. It has image recognition, so it recognizes what page you're on by just looking at the photograph, and is able to augment the illustration with a more of a seamless technology and a special software that was written exactly for this project. So it's almost the next step. Like I said, QR codes, I saw an article on Google like last week that said they're going to be obsolete in like a week. So this is kind of the next step of that. And then when we get to, after we finish this kind of category of moving up in scale from objects to cities to worlds, we get to this final category, and it's projects that don't fit into this scale necessarily, but they fit into the category of communication. And we call this category double entendre because it's projects that have to deal with translation, have to deal with communication, but more importantly, miscommunication, and kind of translating certain things that are very hard to translate, feelings, emotions, color, and trying to communicate these emotional states. And this is a project that has garnered a lot of attention by a Japanese designer named Sputniko. She's British and Japanese. In Britain, she's a designer. In Japan, she's a pop star. And with every piece that she's created, she creates a character, and then creates a song and a music video around the character, and a device that that kind of exemplifies this character's emotional state. So in this case, she took on the character of a transgender male named Takashi, who wanted to know what it was like to actually be a girl. And so what Takashi invents is a menstruation machine. This kind of chastity belt type thing that has electrodes in the front that cause cramping, and you're able to draw blood from other parts of your body and put it into the reservoir in the back of the belt. And again, this is the type of project that isn't going to be manufactured. It's a critical piece. You know, it's a piece that exemplifies the idea of translating what it's like to be one gender to another. Another piece that's in the double entendre section deals more straightforwardly with translation, and it's these little toys that come with candy in Japan, and they are the kanji character for dog, and then it's a transformer that transforms actually into a dog, and therefore all these different animals. So it's a way of teaching children to read. And then there's subliminal messaging, and this is a project done by a group of designers called Swamp, and what they did was print the print the names of every Iraqi citizen that has been killed so far. A very, very, very tiny, you can hardly read it, onto these legal pads. They look like normal legal pads from with a naked eye. But if you magnify the lines on the legal pads, it's the names of all of these Iraqi citizens. And then they delivered a giant pallet of these to the State Department to get the memorial of the people who've been killed due to the Iraqi war into the records of the State Department. And a funny story about this is when we received them, that there was a big note on them put on there by a registrar that said, "These are not for writing on. These are a work of art," because they look just like a regular legal pad. So that brings me to the end of my talk. I wanted to leave some time for questions. And I really do hope you go up and experience the show. Thanks. Any questions? Yeah?
You said earlier in the presentation you had to make a decision about how to build in the iPad.
Yes.
But in your presentation just now, I don't think you did show
it. There are a few pieces that I didn't show. I only showed like 3 or 4 from each category. There's over 180 projects up there. But Carl, Talking Carl, that first one I showed, let me see. So, Talking Carl here, this is an iPad, and it's in this little box, and then people interact with the iPad, and then it's projected large onto the screen. So that's one way we did it, was hooking the iPad up to a projector and having it very large. The problem with that is that people come in and try to interact with the projection when they really should be interacting with the iPad. And then in another section, we have 3 apps that have to deal with sound and music in that double entendre section, translating kind of movement and color on the iPad into music. And we have a whole bank of them in this, in something kind of like this, like a podium with headphones, so people can go and interact with them. Yeah?
I have 2 questions. Number one, how long is your website going to be up for this?
The website ends up being up forever. I think the website has become more and more an important part of the exhibition. We used to, of course, always, we still do produce a catalog, which is a record of the show, but the website is also this kind of record that we like to have and always go back to of the show.
Which brings me to the second question, archiving this art. I mean, like you said, a few things may already be obsolete in a month,
right,
in a year. So if you are also, if the museum also wants to collect art and design like this, how do you collect it? You may not even be able to pay back.
Right, that's a huge, huge question that I deal with every day. And we just hired a few years ago a media conservator, because we do have a media department here also at MoMA. And when we're acquiring software, it really ends up being about acquiring the code to do a game or to do a software program. But the code isn't necessarily enough. In many cases, the code has to be annotated by the programmer because it's very personal, the way people write code. And so from what I understand, if we're going to kind of keep these pieces for posterity, right, we have to have the code. We also have to have an annotated version of the code. We have to have the program that it was written in. We have to have the hardware that the program was written in. And then, for example, we have several pieces that were designed by John Maeda, I think in 1999, for OS 9 on an original iMac. And we just had those displayed in the gallery last year. And when they break, no one sells an original iMac anymore. So then we go to eBay, like, where do we get these pieces? And the hardware isn't in the collection, but in order to play what is in the collection, we need the hardware. And, you know, all of these questions, it's a really, really interesting topic, and we're constantly talking about it. But what are you actually collecting? Are you collecting the fact that this designer has put out an interaction? So maybe the best thing is not to collect the iPad, the code, the program, and all of these things for Talking Carl. Maybe the best thing is to collect a video of someone interacting with Carl. So you really have to question, what are you collecting? Because it's no longer about having this unique object. It's something that can be kind of recreated ad infinitum. And I think we really confronted this last year when we collected, we acquired 23 digital typefaces, which is also up in the galleries right now in another show called Standard Deviations. And we acquired the code of these typefaces, and we acquired the programs that are going to be needed to preserve these fonts for posterity. But you know, then the question becomes, if we have to play it on a different computer than it was intended for, is that the original piece? If it's emulated, like you can have a software designer come in and rewrite the code to emulate exactly what the people were experiencing when they first used the program, but it's not the original, it's not on the original hardware, so then is that pointless? Is it important? It's all of these questions that are constantly being discussed and constantly being worked out all the time. It's kind of the idea of a film. When we collect a film, do we collect the old celluloid? Do we collect the DVD? Do we want the advanced version? And all of that is always a topic for conversation. So I don't know. Basically, that's my answer. I don't know. Any other questions? Yeah. Liminal spaces. So these kind of border spaces between the real and the virtual. We kind of decided to call projects that dealt with that liminal spaces. Any other questions? Thanks very much for coming.